I have to go upstairs and record something again, so...
Quiet.
Do not...
smash anything.
And do not disturb.
Do not disturb.
Do not come into your room.
You're listening to Pandemic, a podcast from RTE News and Current Affairs on the COVID-19 crisis. I'm Colm O'Mungoyne, and each week I'll be talking to RTE's correspondents, reporters and others to bring you news, updates and analysis you can trust. We can guarantee you a high quality of information. Sound quality, on the other hand, might vary somewhat. The correspondents and I will be recording this in many cases on mobile devices from home, so please do bear with us. It's Thursday, May 27th, episode 88 of Pandemic. If you heard last week's episode with Dr. Joanne Liu of the Independent Panel for Pandemic Preparedness and Response, the report she spoke about is being presented at the World Health Assembly this week, and we'll see no doubt what changes that affects, if any, over the coming months. Well, we're going to look at waivers in this episode and some other legal issues. The specific question we're going to look at is, if delayed AstraZeneca or Janssen doses become available at a time when it's younger people's turn to get vaccinated, could they sign a waiver and opt to take those vaccines even if the National Immunisation Advisory Council deem it unsuitable for them? Now, it's not proposed on any official level to offer people under 40 any of those vaccines at present, but what we're going to look at is it legally possible? Simon Mills is both a qualified medical doctor and a senior counsel, and he's going to look at those questions and more next. So, Simon Mills, thanks very much for talking to the Pandemic Podcast.
No problem.
We know each other, so I know you're slightly older than I am, so have you been jabbed yet, dare I ask?
I had my jab appointment, but it turned out to be on the one day that week that I couldn't go and get the jab, so I had to postpone it. So I think I've gone back to the back of the queue, so I'm really rather hoping that my number comes up again so that I have that reassurance sorted in the not too distant future.
Right. And you are also a qualified doctor in a former life. You worked as a doctor and indeed were a regular guest of the late Jerry Ryan, I think, on his radio show, giving out medical advice to all and sundry who called in to a variety of unusual problems. So how's that been? Has that role cropped up again for you during this crisis?
Certainly the media side of it hasn't really, but when there was that brief period, I think, of about a week to 10 days where there was a really genuine concern the health system could be, you know, overwhelmed. And I had been involved in advising one of the committees that was giving input into NPHET on how to manage decision making if the health systems were overwhelmed. And that having brought home to me the fact that anybody with medical qualifications may end up being useful. So I put my name back on the medical register. But happily, both I think for my own sense of well-being and in particular the patient's sense of well-being, it has not been necessary for me to minister to anybody.
We never got to that stage, but you're thick enough skinned not to take it as an insult anyway. Having been put to the back of the vaccine queue and not to have your services called on, you're not beginning to suspect that somebody in the health service doesn't like you.
Well, I'm sure it's well above the level of mere suspicion.
Right.
But I think it's safe to say that I'm sure that GPs with atrophied healthcare skills were hardly in the front rank of the doctors that the system was ever going to need. And I brought my losing my place in the vaccine queue on myself.
Okay, grand. Well, look, let's go to your legal career then. How has that been over the last while, operating courts and Zoom and dealing with clients and even the basics of what would have been paperwork in the past, all of that going electronically? Was that just a complete meltdown?
It took a while to adopt to. I mean, my sense of things when this originally all broke out early last year and before I was aware of Zoom and the degree to which platforms for virtual discussions had moved on, my initial sense was, my God, when will we ever be back to work? And there are important issues at play here. When will those who have really important aspects of their life waiting to be litigated get their day in court? But in the end, thanks to a lot of hard work and a lot of ingenuity, both within the court services and by colleagues who got involved in setting up virtual platforms for court hearings, things have gradually returned to something that it's certainly not normal, But it's a facsimile of normal, so that urgent hearings are able to take place in person in court, or then there's been an increased move from the idea that virtual hearings wouldn't be foisted on people to the idea that virtual hearings should be the norm where they're available, unless there's a good argument for them not proceeding. And all of that allows justice to be administered properly, and at a more venal level allows us to get back to work in most settings. And unlike a lot of my colleagues, I do a lot of work outside the conventional court system. So I do cases at the medical council and in coroner's courts and various other settings like that. And because I do, it's been interesting to see the diversity of response in different settings. So some settings have been really quite risk averse and inquiries haven't proceeded. Other settings have been, even in the depths of the pandemic, and particularly outside Dublin, we're happy for inquiries to proceed, but with appropriate social distancing. So the system found a way. It's still very much not back to normal. And there are a lot of people who, you know, are going to have to wait for their day in court. But with any luck over the next year or so, that backlog will start to be cleared by whether it's the appointment of extra judges or sitting for longer periods during the day or during the year. It should be possible to bring everything back online.
Right, well, let's get into the meat of what we were going to talk about today, which is, vaccines are the talk of the town at the moment. Everybody, as we opened this conversation, is curious about whether or not anyone is vaccinated, where they are in the queue, where they're not in the queue. And one of the things that came up was the supply of Johnson & Johnson and AstraZeneca, and we had an update on that today. There was a disruption of that, and there may be more arriving later in the summer at a time when younger people will be vaccinated. But these vaccines aren't recommended for younger people. So is there any barrier to them signing a waiver to take it if that became available? And maybe just explain kind of the legal principle behind waivers before attempting a possible yes or no answer on that.
So a waiver is a deal, if you like, it's a side deal that two parties do when there's an agreement to provide goods or services. So if you are going to provide to me an experimental medical treatment, you might tell me that it's experimental. You might sweeten the deal by providing the treatment to me for free. And I would, in exchange, promise not to sue you in the event that the treatment went awry in due course. And that's the kind of legal waiver I think we're talking about here. And in fact, waivers arise at two levels in the provision of vaccines. They arise both at the corporate level, and then they can in principle arise at the individual level. So Johnson & Johnson and Pfizer vaccines, for example, have been supplied to the state, and part of the deal for supplying them to the state is that the state has waived its right to bring the manufacturers of the vaccine into any litigation that may arise. So there's already that waiver in place. The state has waived its right to be able to sue the manufacturers if the state is sued in due course. The issue of waivers in the healthcare setting at the individual level is really complicated. It is not typically a feature of the Irish healthcare landscape.
So is it a yes or no matter, Simon? Could a waiver be offered to people outside the current definition of what's appropriate for age groups in vaccines for the likes of AstraZeneca and Johnson & Johnson?
In principle, a waiver could be created, but the legal logistics of it are much more complicated than might first appear. If a person signs such a waiver, would it in fact be binding?
Does that, take into account their level of competence in signing a waiver to make a medical assessment and assess the risk? Is there a level of the law recognising they may not be capable of doing so?
Well, it goes to a couple of things. The first is, of course, that for the purposes of two parties making an agreement, they both have to be competent to enter into that agreement. So you're absolutely right, Colm. If, you know, a child couldn't sign a waiver, and I think it's probable that a parent would not be entitled to sign a waiver in respect of a child. A person with significant cognitive decline probably couldn't sign one. They might be, it might depend on circumstances. But it's more actually to do with the quality of the waiver itself. You would need to look at what is being proposed. What does the waiver actually say? To what extent are you being asked to waive your rights? Are the intentions of the party set out clearly? And a poorly drafted waiver won't be enforceable. The second thing is that although a waiver might look like it creates an immunity for the provider of a scheme of vaccination, such as the state, it will only do so in certain circumstances. So, for example, if the state set about vaccinating people, and if it became clear quite early on, and sorry, this is purely a thought experiment, I'm not saying that this or anything like it could happen, but let's say after about 2 weeks, for example, that 17-year-olds were getting the vaccine and they were suffering a particular unusual reaction, and those 17-year-olds had signed a waiver, it may well be that the waiver would cover this entirely unanticipated reaction. But let's say, notwithstanding that evidence, which should have alerted the state to the fact that the vaccine should now be stopped, they then continued to vaccinate more 17-year-olds, exposing them to the risk of which they now knew. It may well be that at some point in that process, it became negligent and grossly negligent to continue giving the vaccine to the 17-year-olds. And in that case, the waiver signed by the later batches of 17-year-olds may not apply.
Offering the likes of inducements to take the vaccines, or the reverse of that situation, if telling people they can't fulfill certain roles unless they take a vaccine, does that interfere at all with the notion of the consent they gave to the taking of that vaccine?
It is true to say that if you compel somebody to take the vaccine or offer an inducement that is obviously the difference between them saying yes and saying no, that that can undermine the voluntariness of the consent that has been given.
Right. And to go back to what you were saying about the state offering some level of legal immunity to Johnson & Johnson and Pfizer, does the agreement that the state entered into with the manufacturers of those vaccines explain to a certain degree the added layer of caution that has been adopted in making age recommendations for vaccines? Because I think the European Union took what was seen as a pretty cautious approach with regard to negotiating on liability with AstraZeneca as well. But for the Irish state to put in an added layer of caution via the National Immunisation Advisory Council, what might be the legal reason for that?
Well, the presumption that I would adopt in looking at vaccination decisions that are being made, and in fact all of the pandemic-related decisions that are being made by public health specialists, is that first and foremost they're applying public health decision-making criteria rather than legal criteria. So I suppose it's important to observe that for a comparatively small country that can be reasonably optimistic about vaccinating the vast majority of its population reasonably quickly, that it's not unreasonable to adopt a precautionary principle and to give the safest possible vaccine for each age group that is available. So my presumption is that it's a health-based decision. And the reality is that the same group of public healthcare professionals can look at the same situation and come to slightly different conclusions about how they choose to balance risk and benefit.
So if, for example, there was a drying up of supply of other vaccines by other manufacturers and the only thing left on the pitch was AstraZeneca, they could change their advice, but without there being any different legal construct on how that's been offered. Would that be a fair assessment? As long as it's in line with the EMA's recommendations.
I think that's right. And in principle, at least, one might, in drastic situations, even be free to depart. I mean, there are limited circumstances in which medication can be used for purposes for which it is not licensed. So if tomorrow a new variant emerged and only one vaccine worked for it, and this new variant was not only amenable only to one vaccine, but was also significantly more serious with a significantly escalated mortality, one could anticipate that there would be no criticism attached to a public healthcare decision that said, right, we switch tomorrow to using the new vaccine. But all of these things are going to be a question of science and a question of circumstances.
In general, what are the main legal issues that crop up when it comes to the administration of new vaccines? Because we have seen some parents, families take the state, indeed, and vaccine manufacturers to the courts as a result of alleged adverse outcomes of vaccines. Is this pretty typical? Are cases taken as test cases when these things arise?
Well, there are... It's quite a long answer to that question. I suppose to start first of all with the idea of vaccines and complications. There have in the past been vaccinations that have simply been dangerous, which in due course, because there were comparatively high risks of side effects. So there was a polio vaccine catastrophe in, I think it was in New York in the early part of the 20th century. And one has constantly moved towards the administration of the safest possible form of any given vaccine for any given condition. And that is always the trend. When a vaccine is introduced, liability can arise in a number of different ways if you look at it from as a lawyer. The first is the product itself, and there is a piece of legislation called the Liability for Defective Products Act, which is the manifestation in Irish law of a products liability directive from Europe. And that sets out certain legal rules that relate to the manufacture and production and placing on the market of products. And that would apply to something like a vaccination. And so the manufacturers and suppliers and distributors of these products have certain responsibilities to put safe products on the market. But even assuming that the product is safe, the system for actually giving the vaccine also then has to be properly and responsibly mediated in accordance with generally accepted standards of healthcare providers. So it has to be given to the right people. It has to be given in the right way. It has to be given in a manner that doesn't increase the risk of infections because somebody's doing it with dirty hands and that sort of thing. And then the third thing is the informational component of it all, which is that people having this vaccine having been manufactured and this vaccine being about to be given, people have to understand what it is they're getting and consent to receiving it. And this goes back, I think, to the one aspect of the question that you asked at the beginning was, this is a new vaccine. And people can only be informed about what the clinicians know about. So
they can only deal with the known knowns at this stage.
Exactly. And two things can arise. One, which has occasionally arisen in the context of other healthcare products, and I'm not speaking specifically about vaccines here, is that manufacturers or producers are aware of particular problems with a product, but never disclose it or minimize it, so that clinicians are put in the position of not being able to tell a patient about a particular problem, even though that problem exists, because they don't know about it or because it has been minimized by the manufacturer. And then the second problem that can arise is, of course, that when a product is being manufactured and studied, it's studied on dozens of people originally and then hundreds of people and then maybe thousands of people. And then it ends up getting administered to millions of people. And it can happen that when it's being administered to millions of people, problems that weren't previously obvious can start to either become obvious or to be suggested. And the example of this is probably with one of the vaccines. There was a question about whether blood clots arose. And this became apparent once you start administering the vaccine to huge numbers of people. And as new information comes to light, that information becomes something that A, needs to be factored into whether the vaccine should continue to be used and who it should be used on, but also the information transaction that is part of administering the vaccine to the patient.
And when giving the information to people, if they would prefer, if they have a preference to have a different vaccine, for example, is there any obligation there? Is there any obligation to provide it in a timely fashion? Or is that a matter of what is allowed by the circumstances at any given time?
As a matter of law, a patient cannot require a doctor or a nurse to give them treatment A if treatment B is what is being offered and is, in the view of the person offering the treatment, the right treatment for their condition. So they can refuse treatment B. They can say they would prefer to have treatment A. But if treatment A isn't on offer, either because of a public health care decision or because the treatment simply doesn't exist in the state, for example. I mean, there are lots of different scenarios that might arise. You can't, as it were, legally stamp your foot and say, well, I must have the treatment that I want. And that is true both at the public health level, but also in, you know, really difficult cases like treating cancer in children. You can see very sad and difficult cases where the patients say, well, I want my child to have this new treatment. And the doctors say, the new treatment will not save your child. And applications have been made in the courts in this country and in other countries saying, well, I command you, court, to direct that the doctors treat my child with the treatment that I want for my child. And the courts have looked at that situation and said, no, these are medical decisions to be made by medical people with all of the relevant information. And you don't have a right to demand a certain treatment. So if the state makes a reasoned decision that vaccine A is available to group A, you are free to refuse vaccine A. And maybe in due course, the guidance will change and group A will be entitled to vaccine B or vaccine C, and then you can get it. But you can't refuse vaccine A and also insist that public health policy is changed in your particular instance. Now, that's not an absolute rule. There could be circumstances where a case could be made that the rules are messed up or wrong, or that you fall on one side of the line rather than the other. But as a matter of generality, there isn't an entitlement conferred on a patient to demand a particular treatment to which the clinicians must bend.
Right. And finally, then, I suppose, you know, the WHO, even before the current pandemic, and we touched on this in our podcast last week, there had been warnings for years that a global pandemic was on the way. I think most people now believe that it's possible and have seen the consequences of it. But if in the future we saw another pandemic, and let's hope we don't, is it within the power of the state to compel people to take vaccines if it's deemed a sufficiently serious public emergency?
At the level of principle, there is no reason why a law could not be introduced to compel vaccination. However, because we are a constitutional democracy, any law that you might introduce would have to have an incredibly compelling rationale to overcome the suite of constitutional rights that patients or that citizens would be entitled to invoke to say, hang on a second, state, I would prefer not to be vaccinated. So I think that absent the most compelling circumstances, it's hard to see how such a scheme would work. But those compelling circumstances are not hard to imagine. Let's assume that COVID, instead of having COVID symptoms, had Ebola's symptoms, and let's assume that it had Ebola's mortality rate, and let's assume that it had arrived in Ireland. Might that then justify compulsory vaccination? There has to be an argument that it might. So in short, I mean, one of the interesting things that public health brings out is that there is an approach to healthcare that is not about the individual. It is based on cold utilitarian calculations about what is best for society. And if that involves compelling us to stay at home, preventing us from travel, abridging our rights as EU citizens or as citizens of this state, then so be it. That underpins a lot of the rationale of public health. And the degree to which that utilitarian instinct will be brought to bear, and it's a pretty crude instrument, will always be a function of the degree of threat posed by the particular public health issue that has arisen.
It sounds like over the past year or so, there's been plenty of food for thought as you consider the medical legal issues in which you're an expert. But from your own point of view, looking at the kind of balances that have to be struck and where public health is balanced with law and the rights of the individual, and indeed even cases that have gone through the courts, is it breaking new ground, or are these all dealing with established legal principles that have been seen in case law many times before?
Well, it's a bit of both. The established principles have been brought to bear on a novel situation. So you will have seen the Gemma O'Doherty and John Waters legal cases, insofar as they advanced any arguments of substance at all, and one can see what the courts made of the substance of their arguments.
I think they described it as absurd and without merit.
Yes, you might think that. I couldn't possibly comment. I mean, look, the reality is it was not an argument of legal substance, but insofar as it invoked principles, it didn't really invoke any new principles. It applied them to an unprecedented situation. Insofar as people are going through the courts for refusing to wear face masks, that is raising issues that don't come up very often about your freedom of expression or your conscientious objection. And, you know, let's assume good faith, and let's assume that everybody who doesn't want to wear a mask or who rejects public health guidelines does so for good reasons and for good motives and from a position of conscientiousness. Well, when conscientious objection comes up against the common good, then difficult balancing acts have to be engaged in by the courts and by the Oireachtas. And so these things have come more to the fore, but they have existed as part of the Irish of Irish jurisprudence and Irish statutory background for some time. I mean, if you look at the abortion legislation when it was introduced, it includes provision for conscientious objection. So these are things that are present in the Irish legal landscape, but COVID has forced us to focus on them perhaps more acutely and in a very concentrated period of time.
All right. Well, look, the very best of luck with getting further up the queue for your own job. And hopefully the next time we speak, it may well be face to face and without a mask. Here's hoping anyway.
Colin, thank you very much.
And that's it for another episode. You can get in touch by email on colm.omungain@rte.ie, colm.omungain@rte.ie, or on Twitter @colm.omungain. Do leave us a review or a rating on your podcast platform of choice. Recommend us to a friend or share this on social media. But until next week, take care, stay safe, and thanks for listening.